This audio is presented for informational and educational purposes only. It reflects analysis and opinion based on publicly available information and investigative interpretation. It does not constitute legal, financial, or professional advice and should not be relied upon as such.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Usually this is where we grab a bestseller off the shelf or maybe dive into a whole stack of investigative articles. We're always trying to figure out what's really happening in the world.
Right. What's the story this week?
Exactly. But today is different. We're not looking at a story. We are looking at the machinery behind the story.
That's a very distinct shift. Yeah. We're not analyzing a narrative today. We're analyzing a briefing. A manual, almost.
A manual is a good word for it. I was handed this document earlier this week, and I have to admit, my first reaction was, okay, this is dense. It's titled, Statement on Power, Resources, and Civic Responsibility.
Doesn't exactly roll off the tongue.
Not at all. It doesn't have a flashy cover, no celebrity blurb. I mean, it looks like something you'd find in a launch filing cabinet in the basement of some government agency.
It really does. It reads like an operating manual, or maybe. Yeah. Maybe more like a warning label for the civilization we're all living inside.
So here's the plan for our time together. We're going to try something a little new. We're going to shift gears and really step into the role of mentors. Mentors delivering a professional training brief.
Right.
So if you're listening to this, I want you to imagine you're not just, on your commute or doing the dishes. Imagine you're sitting in a windowless room. The door is locked. And we are walking you through the curriculum on how structural power actually works.
And the objective here is very, very specific. We aren't here to debate the morality of power today. We're not going to be saying this is fair or that's unfair.
No.
We're here to analyze the mechanics. The document lays out a specific toolkit that it claims is required to navigate the world as it actually is, not, as we might wish it were.
There's a hook right at the start that really grabbed me, and honestly, it's a little unsettling. It poses this central tension, this binary state of existence.
It's very stark.
It really is. It suggests that you are either a master of these systems, you understand finance, law, administrative structures, or you are, and this is the quote, governed by them.
There's no middle ground. That's the cold water right in the face, isn't it? You're either the player or you're the piece being moved on the board.
So let's get into the core thesis here. The document calls this whole thing the purpose of the archive. And it says this entire briefing it's a rejection of ignorance.
Mm.
It explicitly states that we have to move beyond outrage. We have to move beyond slogans. The only effective response to structural power is what the text calls disciplined competence.
Disciplined competence. I want to pause on that for a second because at first glance, it sounds like something from a corporate buzzword memo.
Something you'd see on a motivational poster.
Exactly. But it's actually quite radical when you unpack it. It's essentially saying your anger is useless. Your protests, they're largely performative. If you actually want to change the outcome, you have to become as competent, as boring, and as technically proficient as the people running the machine.
So let's unpack that machine. The document starts with what it calls the physics of power. And it makes a claim that feels almost, futile. It says power begins with resources, not politics.
Yeah, we tend to think of power as, who's sitting in the Oval Office or who holds the gavel in Parliament. But this text scripts it all the way back to the absolute basics.
It's the ground level.
To the literal ground. Power is about land. It's about water, food, labor, value, the things you can actually touch, the things you need to survive. I mean, throughout all of history, if you control the resources, you control the people. That hasn't changed just because we carry iPhones around now.
But the mechanism has changed, hasn't it? The document mentions that while open conflict, war, conquest, that still exists, but the game has shifted.
You're subtle now.
It seems so. The modern conquest isn't necessarily an invading army marching down Main Street. It's expanded through, and I'm quoting here, economic pressure, regulatory regimes, and administrative system.
And that is the critical distinction. If you're looking for a soldier at the gate, you might miss the zoning board official or the central banker.
Because they don't look like a threat.
Exactly. The document highlights that these systems are designed, specifically designed, to operate beyond public scrutiny. They're boring on purpose. They're administrative on purpose because nobody pays attention to boring things.
Okay, let's drill down into the how of that, because administrative systems still sounds a bit abstract.
Okay, let's take a real-world example. Let's look at water. In the old days, a warlord would capture the well and demand tribute. Simple?
Very direct.
Very direct. Today, a regulatory body, maybe a water management district, reclassifies a local aquifer as industrial runoff or non-potable due to some obscure section in a new code.
Okay.
So now the local community can no longer legally use it. The land value around there plummets because, well, there are no water rights. Then a large conglomerate buys up that land for pennies on the dollar.
Because it's worthless without water.
Yeah, precisely. Then they petition the very same board to install a filtration plant. They get the water reclassified, and suddenly they own the resource.
Wow.
No shots fired, just paperwork. A few hearings, nobody attended.
That is terrifyingly efficient. And it leads us directly into the next concept in the document, which is narrative control. It uses the phrase official history.
Mm.
We've all heard the saying, right? History is written by the victors.
History is written by the conqueror, not the conquered.
Wow.
But this document, it takes that idea a step further. It says, official history is the record of winners, not reality.
What's the distinction there?
It argues that what we see in the history books, the language of reform, of stability, of necessity, that's just the perspective of power. It's the justification. It minimizes the coercion. It completely erases the loss.
There's a specific case study mentioned in the source material that illustrates this perfectly. It talks about the Las Palmas community and the Miccosukee tribe. Now, I hadn't looked deeply into this before, but the document frames it as just a masterclass in this kind of narrative control.
Yes. This is a very poignant example, and it's worth digging into. The official record, the one you might find in a state archive or, you know, on a plaque in a park, it would probably frame the displacement of these communities as progress.
Right.
Or, as the document notes, it might be framed as a heroic effort to save the Everglades.
And saving the Everglades sounds objectively good. I mean, who could possibly argue with saving a vital wetland? It sounds noble.
Exactly. And that is the narrative shield. It's unassailable. But the document forces you to ask, what was left out of that story? What's not on the plaque?
Hmm.
The official history excludes the human consequences. It excludes the cultural erasure. It excludes the economic destruction that was borne by the communities whose lands were, and these are the document's words, constrained, reclassified, or destroyed to make that conservation area possible.
So the argument isn't that saving the Everglades was necessarily a bad thing, but that the cost of doing so was forced onto a specific group of people who had no say in the matter.
Yes.
And then the history of that cost was just wiped clean.
Precisely. The official record survives as what the text calls justification and victory language. It doesn't record what was taken from people. It records why it was supposedly necessary to take it. It turns theft into public policy.
And that explains why the archive, the very concept of this document we're reading, is so important. It's an attempt to preserve the reality, not just the justification.
It's the counterledger.
Right. But moving on to the next pillar of this physics of power, we have to talk about the people running the show, or maybe more accurately, the lack of people. The document has a section titled Systems, Not Individuals.
This is a big one. This is where people often get tripped up. We're wired, you know, as humans to look for villains. We want to point a finger and say, oh, that politician is greedy or that CEO is a monster.
We want a simple bad guy.
We do. But the document challenges that misconception, and it does so aggressively. It says you're looking at the wrong thing. It's not about the person. It's about the role they occupy in the system.
It describes the architects of these systems as highly intelligent, disciplined, and strategic.
They are not stumbling into dominance. This isn't an accident. And here's the kicker that I think most people miss. They do not primarily work for money.
What do you mean? Of course they work for money.
The document argues that wealth is just a tool. It's leverage. Influence, control, shaping outcomes. That is the objective. If you think they're just chasing a bigger quarterly bonus, you are fundamentally underestimating the game they're playing. They're not just making money. They're building engines of control.
That's a scary thought. If money is just a tool, then what is the role of the politician? The document is pretty harsh here. It calls them interchangeable operators.
It really is. It says they rotate faces but do not control outcomes. Think about a factory machine. You can change the operator who pushes the big green button. You can put a nice operator there, a mean operator, a charismatic one.
Right.
But if the machine is built to stamp out metal sheets, it's going to stamp out metal sheets regardless of who is standing there pushing the button. The machine does what the machine was being to do.
So the argument is that removing a politician, say, in an election, without dismantling the underlying financial, regulatory, and administrative structures, changes. Nothing.
Precisely. Power persists because it's structural, not personal. You can vote out the face, but the regulatory regime remains. The debt structures remain. The administrative inertia remains. The machine just keeps humming along, waiting for the next operator.
This brings us to the second segment of our briefing, the mechanisms of control. If power is structural, how does the structure actually, you know, keep people in line without using brute force every single day? The document points to two things: fear and ignorance.
It calls them psychological weaponry, and the phrasing is very deliberate. Modern systems rarely depend on force alone. They depend on ignorance and fear, deliberately cultivated and carefully maintained.
That phrase, carefully maintained, that implies intent, doesn't it? It implies a cycle.
It is a cycle.
Yeah.
And honestly, reading this part of the document, it felt a little too familiar. It's the cycle of the current thing, whatever that may be.
Break that down.
First, knowledge threatens power. If you understand how the machine actually works, you might be able to stop it, or at least jam the gears. So power weaponizes fear in response. It creates a boogeyman.
And when that fear starts to weaken, when people get used to it or start to get comfortable,
a crisis is declared. There's always a new crisis. And when that crisis loses its urgency, new instability is introduced. It's a perpetual motion engine of anxiety.
The mentor's perspective here, as laid out in the document, is that this isn't accidental. We often look at the news and think, wow, the world is just so chaotic right now.
Right. Everything is so crazy.
But the document says, no, the chaos is functional. The chaos serves a purpose.
Instability becomes governance by other means. If people are afraid, afraid of a virus, afraid of a war, afraid of an economic collapse, they look for safety. They look for authority. They willingly accept things they would never, ever accept in times of calm.
They trade liberty for a feeling of security.
Every single time. It's the oldest trade in the book.
And the most effective instrument for this control, according to this source, isn't the police or the military. It's the market.
Financial control. The document is incredibly clear on this point. Financial mechanisms are the most efficient instruments of control. You don't need a prison guard standing over someone. If that person has to work three jobs just to pay the interest on their loans, they've imprisoned themselves.
It lists four specific mechanisms. And I want to go through these in detail because they're technical, but the document argues they affect every single person listening. The first one is devaluation.
Devaluation is. It's the silent theft. It reduces your purchasing power without your consent. Just think about inflation.
Right.
If you work for a dollar and that dollar buys 10% less next year, 10% of your labor has been effectively stolen from you. You didn't vote for a pay cut. You didn't agree to it. It just happened because of decisions made in a central bank boardroom that you will never, ever enter.
The second is debt.
Debt converts future labor into present leverage. This is absolutely crucial to understand. When you are in debt, you are not free. Your future time, the hours you will work next year and the year after that, and the year after that already belongs to the holder of that debt.
So it limits your options.
It creates a compliant population because people cannot afford to step out of line. You can't go on strike if you're going to miss a mortgage payment. You can't tell your boss what you really think. You're leveraged.
The third is volatility. This is the one that really struck me. The quote is, volatility transfers assets upward during crises.
Let's explain the mechanics of that because it sounds complex, but it's brutally simple. Think about every major economic crash we've seen.
Right.
Small businesses fail. Individuals lose their homes because they lose their job and can't pay the mortgage. So, who buys those assets? Who buys the foreclosed house or the bankrupt competitor?
The people who still have cash. The ones who weren't wiped out.
Exactly. The people on the institutions with the capital reserves to weather the storm. Volatility, in essence, shakes the fruit out of the tree so the people standing at the bottom with big baskets can just catch it. It's a massive cyclical consolidation of ownership.
And the fourth and final mechanism is recovery.
Recovery locks those transfers into place permanently. This is the final turn of the screw. Once the assets have moved upward, once the corporation has bought the house, the system stabilizes, prices go back up, and the previous owners are priced out of their own lives forever.
They become renters in the homes they used to own.
Exactly. And these outcomes, the document stresses, are predictable, repeatable, and structural. This isn't a bug in the system. It's the system operating as designed.
It makes the economy sound less like a free market and more like a harvest.
That is exactly the metaphor the document implies. It is a harvesting of value from the many to the few, and it uses complexity as the scythe.
But how do they get away with it? I mean, why isn't everyone in the streets with pitchforks? The document suggests it's because of the third major mechanism. Complexity is camouflage.
Right. Administrative systems operate most efficiently when understanding is discouraged. It's a core principle. If you make the tax code 70,000 pages long, nobody can argue with it because nobody can actually read it.
So it's not just that it's complicated, it's intentionally complicated.
Intentionally, it's a defensive measure.
The document lists the tactics of bureaucracy. First, as you said, complexity acts as camouflage. Second, procedure replaces accountability.
Think about that phrase for a moment. Procedure replaces accountability. If a bridge collapses or a pension fund is raided and goes to zero, the official investigation doesn't ask, was this the right thing to do, or was this moral?
No, it asks.
It asks, did we follow the procedure? Were the boxes checked? Were the forms filed correctly? And if the answer is yes, then no one is to blame. The system itself protects its operators with its own red tape.
And silence is treated as consent.
Right. This is a classic. If you don't object to the tiny zoning notice that was posted in the basement of the town hall behind a filing cabinet and was only visible for 3 days, well, you consented to the demolition of your entire neighborhood. You just didn't know you were consenting.
And finally, delay is converted into finality.
They can just wait you out. It's a war of attrition. You have a job and a family. They have a whole department with a budget. They can wait 10 years for a permit approval. You can't. By the time your court case is finally heard, the forest has already been cut down. The outcome is decided by the clock.
Okay, so we've established a pretty grim picture here. We have structural power. We have narrative control. We have weaponized fear, financial extraction, and then this bureaucratic camouflage hiding it all. It feels overwhelming.
And that is the point. That's a feature, not a bug. If you feel overwhelmed, you check out, you retreat, you say, it's too big, it's too much. I'll just, watch Netflix and try to forget about it.
But the document pivots here. This is where the brief really begins. This is segment 3, the pivot to mastery.
Yeah.
It starts by telling us what doesn't work. And this is going to be a hard pill for some people to swallow. It says flat out that power is not defeated by outrage, slogans, or withdrawal.
This is the senior mentor advice coming through loud and clear. It's blunt. You cannot fight a structural system with emotion. You can scream at a brick wall all day long, but the wall does not care about your feelings.
A structure is indifferent.
Completely indifferent. You can have the cleverest slogan in the world, the most viral hashtag, but if they control the bond market and the regulatory agencies, you lose. End of story.
So what is the alternative then? If shouting doesn't work, what does?
Disciplined competence. We're back to that phrase again.
This leads to the concept of the lawful counterweight. What does that mean?
The idea is that those who want to confront power or just defend themselves from it must develop the exact same capabilities used to design and operate it.
So, fight fire with fire.
Or, more accurately, fight the spreadsheet with a better spreadsheet. You cannot dismantle a complex financial weapon if you don't understand finance. You can't challenge a regulatory regime if you don't understand administrative law. You have to speak the language of power.
So the goal is to understand, anticipate, constrain, and lawfully counter the rules, the incentives, the contracts, the markets, and the institutions.
Basically, yes. You have to become as smart, as disciplined, and as strategic as the people running the system. You have to beat them in their own boring, complicated game.
Which brings us to the absolute core of this curriculum, segment 4. The 11 required competencies. The document lists these as the minimum standard. This isn't a wish list. This is the toolkit. And honestly, looking at this list, it's intimidating. It looks like a syllabus for a master's degree in running the world.
It is a high barrier, but that's the point, isn't it? The document argues that the high barrier to entry is exactly where the power hides. If the instruction manual for the machine is written in a language you don't speak, you can never fix the machine. So, let's decode the language.
Okay, first up in the toolkit, the framework of rules. This category has two parts. The first is law, and the second is international law.
You have to know the rules of the game. That's square one. And law isn't just for lawyers. It's the operating code of society. It dictates what's possible.
And why the specific mention of international law?
Because capital and power flow across borders effortlessly. If you're only looking at your local laws, you're missing 90% of the game. You need to understand how a treaty signed in Geneva or a trade agreement negotiated in Brussels directly affects your local water rights or your job security.
Then there is political structure.
This goes right back to what we said earlier. Not the face you see on TV, but the actual machinery. How does a bill actually become law? Who writes the regulations that give the law its teeth? How does the administrative state function? If you don't know the mechanics, you're just a spectator in the stands.
It's about knowing where the real leverage points are.
Exactly. You need to know which subcommittee holds the real hearing, and more importantly, who appoints the members of that committee and who funds their campaigns. That's the structure.
Okay, next group. The language of value. This starts with finance and accounting. Now, most people think accounting is just for, you know, doing your taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it on a list about civic responsibility?
Because accounting is the only objective history of what actually happened. Narrative is what they said they did with the money. Accounting is the record of what they actually paid for.
Follow the money.
Literally. But it's even deeper than that. Think about a city or a company going bankrupt. The politicians will give soaring speeches about unforeseen global market forces or some other excuse.
Right. It was nobody's fault.
But if you know, if you can read a balance sheet and a cash flow statement, you can look at the lines from 3 years ago and say, no, you leveraged the city's assets 40-1 on incredibly risky bets. This wasn't an accident. This was a choice.
So accounting is a lie detector.
It's the ultimate lie detector. The document says, and I think this is a critical line, if you cannot read a ledger, you are blind to the primary mechanism of your own governance. If you don't know where the tax revenue actually went, you can't complain that the rows aren't fixed. You're just shouting into the void.
It's a powerful point. Fair enough. But then it pivots to valuation. This one seemed a little specific, maybe just for investors. Why does a regular citizen need to understand valuation?
To avoid being looted, plain and simple. Valuation is the art and science of determining what an asset is actually worth, not what someone tells you it's worth.
Give me a real-world example of how that applies to a normal person, not someone on Wall Street.
Okay, perfect example. Public-private partnerships. Okay. You hear this term all the time. A city decides to sell its parking meters to a private company for a big one-time lump sum of, say, $10 million to plug a hole in the budget this year.
Sounds like a quick fix. The politicians get to hold a press conference and announce they balanced the budget without raising taxes. Everyone's happy.
It sounds great on the 6 o'clock news. But if you understand valuation, you don't listen to the press conference. You go home and you run the numbers. You calculate the future cash flow of those meters over the next 75 years of the contract. You discount it back to the present. You adjust for inflation and maintenance, and you realize the true value was $400 million.
Oh, wow.
The city didn't fix the budget. The city was robbed of $390 million in future value. And the citizens are going to pay higher parking rates for the rest of their lives, all because the voters didn't understand the math.
That makes me angry just hearing it.
Good. But the document's advice is don't just get angry. Get competent. Learn to do the math so you can stand up at the city council meeting and stop the deal before it's signed.
Now we get into what feels like the heavy artillery, the mechanics of leverage. This section lists derivatives and fixed income securities.
Most people hear the word derivatives and their eyes glaze over. They just tune out. And that is exactly what the system wants. These are the tools used for that massive transfer of assets we talked about earlier. They are the plumbing of modern finance.
Okay, we need to stop and define derivatives simply because the document calls them tools of leverage. What are we actually talking about here?
Okay, let's try a simple analogy. Imagine a farmer growing wheat. He's worried the price of wheat will drop before he can harvest it. A banker comes along and offers him a contract. I'll guarantee you a price of $5 a bushel no matter what. That contract's value is derived from the underlying price of wheat. It's a derivative.
Okay, that makes sense. It's like insurance.
It starts as insurance. But now, imagine people who don't own any wheat, have never seen a farm, start trading and betting on the price of that contract. Suddenly, the paper market for wheat is 10, 50, 100 times bigger than the actual physical wheat harvest in the entire world.
So it's a casino built on top of the real world.
It's a massive casino. And the document's argument is that this paper market controlled by a very small number of firms is what actually decides the price of your bread, not the farmer or the weather. That is structural power. If you don't understand the basics of fixed income and derivatives, you simply don't understand how the global economy actually functions. You're just watching shadows on the cave wall.
And the next skill is financial modeling.
This is about seeing the future. It's the ability to project outcomes. It's not enough to know where we are today. You have to be able to model where we are going.
So second and third order effects.
Precisely. If interest rates rise by 1%, what happens to your pension fund's assets? What happens to the housing market in your city? What happens to the government's ability to service its debt? Modeling allows you to see the future implications of current policy decisions. It's about not being surprised by the predictable outcome when it finally arrives.
Next is the analytical mind. This has two parts, applied mathematics and statistics.
Data is the new oil. We hear that all the time. But it's also the new propaganda. You need the math to be able to verify the truth for yourself. When a report comes out that says inflation is down, you need the statistical knowledge to ask the right questions.
Like what?
Like, how did you weight the basket of goods? Did you change the methodology from last year? Did you conveniently exclude food and energy because they made the numbers look bad? Statistics is the toolkit you use to cut through the narrative control and get to the raw numbers.
And the other half of this is analytical judgment.
This is the synthesis. This is where it all comes together. You have the law, you have the finance, you have the data. Now, can you put it all together into a coherent worldview? Can you look at a complex situation and make a sound judgment call that isn't based on what the news anchor told you to think 5 minutes ago?
It's the human element.
It's the human element. It's wisdom, not just information.
And finally, the last competency, the delivery. This is communication and presentation.
This is the last mile, and it's just as important as all the others. You can know the truth, you can have all the data, you can understand the fraud inside and out, but if you cannot articulate it effectively, you cannot counter the official history.
You can't win anyone over.
You can't. You have to be able to present your case with clarity and power. You have to be able to stand up in that town hall meeting and explain the valuation error in the parking meter deal in a way that makes sense to your neighbors who don't have a degree in finance.
That is a formidable list. I mean, law, finance, derivatives, statistics, communication. It really does sound like you need to be a lawyer, a banker, and a data scientist all rolled into one person.
It is intimidating. There's no way around that. But the document's argument is, what's the alternative? The alternative is being governed. And maybe you don't need to be a world-class expert in all 11 of them personally. And maybe it's about building a community, a team that possesses these skills collectively. But the goal is mastery. The goal is to not be helpless.
Now, skills are one thing. But the document also makes a strong case for character. Segment 5.
Yeah.
The mindset. It lists what it calls non-negotiable traits.
Yes. Tenacity. Resilience. Intellectual curiosity. Adaptability. Humility. And discipline.
I want to focus on humility for a second. That one seems out of place. Why is humility on a list about acquiring power and competence? Usually, we associate power with arrogance, not humility.
The mentor commentary in the source document is really interesting on this point. It says that arrogance blinds you to the strategies of the highly intelligent and disciplined people who are running these systems.
So if you think you're smarter than them,
you will get crushed instantly. Humility keeps you alert. It keeps you learning. It reminds you that the machine is older and stronger and better funded than you are. So you have to be sharper. You have to be more careful. You can't afford ego.
And then comes the reality check. After the skills, after the traits, the document presents that binary choice again, but this time it's even starker.
It is. It says, if you lack these, you are governed. I mean, just let that sentence hang in the air. If you don't understand these systems, you are a passenger in a car being driven by someone else to a destination you didn't choose. You are just payload.
If you master them, you are no longer predictable.
And that is the definition of freedom in the context of this document. Power works by exploiting ignorance. Fear is the tool used to enforce compliance. Mastery removes both of those vulnerabilities.
How so?
If you are not ignorant, you can't be tricked by the narrative. If you are not afraid, you can't be coerced by the crisis. You become a variable that the system's models cannot easily account for. You become a glitch in their matrix.
This brings us to the final segment, which is really the title of the whole thing, the purpose of the archive. Why does this document exist? Why are we sitting here reading a training brief?
It says it exists as a direct rejection of ignorance as a condition of governance. It's a line in the sand. It's a declaration.
It lists three specific goals. One, no future decision maker may credibly claim ignorance. The information is out there.
Right. I didn't know is no longer a valid excuse.
Two, no citizen may be told this was always the rule. The archive shows when the rule was changed and by whom.
And three, and I think this is the most important, the record must exist before finality is imposed. We have to write the truth down before the official history gets cemented and erases it. We have to document the theft before it's laundered into policy.
The guiding principles here are, they're actually quite empowering. Self-sufficiency begins with education, and perseverance outlasts intimidation.
And the key takeaway, the one sentence summary of the whole thing, documentation is the lawful counterweight to power exercised without transparency. Writing it down matters. Knowing the facts matters. Keeping the receipts, both literal and metaphorical, matters.
So as we wrap up this briefing, let's just synthesize what we've covered. We started with the physics of power, how resources and narratives are controlled. Then we looked at the mechanisms, fear, finance, and complexity.
And from there, we pivoted to the solution. Not outrage, not slogans, but competence. The 11 skills, the mindset of the disciplined student.
The central philosophy here seems to be that structural power depends on, and the quote is, participation without comprehension. Yeah. It needs us to play the game without ever understanding the rules.
Exactly. And it weakens the moment knowledge replaces fear. When you understand how the magician's trick works, it stops being magic. It's just a mechanism. And mechanisms can be understood, they can be anticipated, and sometimes they can be dismantled.
So here is the final provocative thought for you to take away from this briefing. We usually think of mastery, you know, learning finance, learning law, as a career goal. We do it to get a promotion or a raise or a better job title.
But this document challenges you to see it completely differently. Mastery isn't about your career, it's about your liberation. The same mechanisms used to concentrate power can be lawfully countered by those who refuse ignorance.
This isn't just about getting ahead. The argument here is that it's about staying free. The briefing is complete. The work of mastery begins now. Thanks for listening to The Deep Dive.
Stay curious and stay disciplined.